Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
From the Society for Nautical Research, in partnership with Lloyd's Register Foundation, I'm Sam Willis, and this is the Mariner's Mirror podcast, the world's number one podcast dedicated to all of maritime history.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Mariner's Mirror podcast, a truly fantastic story for you today. The Dreadnought Hoax, an event so fantastical I couldn't quite work out what I was reading when I first came across it. So let's start with the bare essentials of this extraordinary tale. In 1910, four white English people, three men and one woman, dressed up as members of the Abyssinian royal family, complete with black face makeup, false beards and magnificent robes, and were given a tour of HMS Dreadnought, the most powerful battleship ever built, the pride of the Royal Navy and the pride of the British Empire. That in itself is remarkable, but even weirder is the fact that the woman in the group was none other than a lady by the name of Virginia Stephen, better known to you all for her married name, for she was none other than the famed writer Virginia Woolf. Though, for this tale, she is, of course, a bearded male member of the Abyssinian royal family. We have a story here that touches on questions of race, gender and empire, on credulity, outrage and humour, on cultural norms and expectations, and it's all wrapped up in the shiny paper of sea power. What a story, what a present. Not only that, but to deliver to our nautical ears this magnificent present, I spoke with the one lady who knows it better than anyone else. Danelle Jones is a writer and scholar with a PhD in literature from Columbia University, and she spoke with me from her home in Montana, where I would very much like to go on holiday. So, to take us from the wilds of Montana via the dusty heat of the Abyssinian Empire in East Africa to the chilly grey waters of Portsmouth and the stern and daunting decks of a British battleship unlike any other that had ever been built, here is the deeply knowledgeable and very lovely Danelle. As ever, I trust you enjoy listening to her as much as I enjoyed talking with her. Danelle, thank you very much indeed for joining me today.
Oh, it's such a pleasure to be here, Sam.
What a wonderful story. I get sent books and ideas about books all the time. And I read this one. I thought it was absolutely fantastic. I knew nothing about it at all. So I've had a really wonderful time learning all about this quite remarkable story. Let's start by just telling people who Horace DeVere Cole was, because none of this makes sense unless you know who this extraordinary character was.
Horace DeVere Cole. Rascal. He was a very wealthy eccentric who defined his life through pranks. And I think they really started when he was at Cambridge. That's where he met Virginia Woolf's brother, Adrian, and they began to do minor pranks there at Cambridge. They did things like join a foot race halfway between, so they were miles ahead of the closest competitor and won the race. Horace would dress up as a bishop and, baptize, or he did something to young boys. And so he just did these crazy pranks. One of the things that he loved doing at Cambridge, when people were sent down, he would do faux funerals to mark that they had been kicked out of the university. So he had plenty of practice doing hoaxes before he got to the Dreadnought hoax.
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating just thinking about this guy. I mean, you say that, you know, we know about what he got up to at Cambridge, but he must have been, what, 19 or so, maybe a bit younger when he was there. There's no way he started doing it age 19. He would have been a nightmare of a kid.
Nightmare of a kid. He was probably a bit older because, interestingly enough, he'd actually been to the Boer War and he was severely injured. And so he thought he was going to make his career as an army officer. But because of his injury, he was out quite quickly. So he was slightly older, but not that much. You know, maybe he was 19, maybe he was 20, but young.
One of the hoaxes Cambridge that really stands out is the Cambridge Zanzibar hoax, because that's got the clear racial lines along which the Dreadnought hoax unfolds. So can you just talk a little about the Cambridge Zanzibar hoax and what Horace got up to there?
Yes. So the Sultan of Zanzibar was actually a pretty well-known figure in England. He had come to England to be schooled, and he was having difficulty with the regent who'd been in charge of his country. So he was trying to get back to England and talk to the king to see if he could get his power back or get his power in the first place after his father died. And so Horace and Adrian Stephen decided that it wouldn't it be grand fun to masquerade as him and hoax the mayor of Cambridge. It turns out that the Sultan had been so often in the newspapers with his pictures. The newspapers of the day loved portraying him as this sort of the Sultan as this debonair man about town, you know, with his tennis racket and his fancy cars, that they got scared at the last minute and decided to be just an uncle. And so they pretend to be an uncle. They dress up. They go to the most important costumer of the time, Willie Clarkson, who, you know, gives them all the costumes. And this is blackface, black hands, just unbelievable by today's standards. And they arrive in Cambridge about 5:30 in the afternoon. They get a complete tour. They go through Trinity College, which is their college. Nobody recognizes them. And they get off pretty much scot-free, although when it's revealed, and of course, Horace wants the attention, so he reports it to all the newspapers. I mean, it's covered in like society magazines like The Tattler, and of course, incredibly embarrassing to the mayor of Cambridge. And the mayor even tries to, he hires a private detective to try to figure out who these people were and to see if he can get them kicked out, but they hadn't done anything illegal, so they managed to get away with it. And afterwards, Cole sets up in his rooms with, you know, exotic fruits and things, handing out signed photographs of the studio portrait he had taken before the hoax. So this is his bread and butter. This is what he loves. He leaves Cambridge without a degree, but claims that he got honors in hoaxing. So this was his identity. Wow.
Okay, so he's got a history of hoaxes. He's got a history of doing elaborate hoaxes concerning high-ranking dignitaries from Africa that involve wearing blackface, that involve going in costume. So, Daniel, how does Virginia Woolf fit into all of this? First off, just tell us a bit about who she was for those who don't recognize the name.
Yes, well, Virginia Woolf was really one of the most important writers of the 20th century. And I think what people really admire about her novels in particular are really the way that they explore human identity and consciousness and experience with really unparalleled depth and sensitivity. So her novels, some of her most famous are Mrs. Dalloway, To the Lighthouse, and The Waves. But, you know, she was also, the other thing that interests me about her, she was also an ardent pacifist, as well as somebody very concerned about women's rights. And I think it's really easy to forget that at her time, women were not taken seriously as artists. So It's important to remember that at the time, famous writers like Arnold Bennett, who was the richest and one of the most popular novelists at the time, was arguing that men were just superior to women. They were more creative. They were more intellectual. There was no comparison. The only writer he considered even comparable to men was Emily Bronte. That was the only woman he would even consider putting in the category of male writers. So as you can imagine, for Virginia Woolf, this irritated her. But it also inspired her to really talk about women's creativity. And, you know, she wrote books like A Room of One's Own, in which she argues that women have been at a disadvantage for a long time and that their creativity needs to be protected and celebrated.
So on the one hand, we've got Horace DeVere Cole, who seems to have been a professional idiot, maybe quite entertaining, but certainly someone who he'd willing to do anything at all. On the other hand, we've got Virginia Woolf, who seems to be incredibly thoughtful, incredibly intelligent, and incredibly talented as an artist. How on earth did these two meet each other?
Yes, great question, Sam. Well, remember in The Hoax, it's 1910. She's only 28 years old. She's working as a journalist, but she hasn't yet published her first novel. And she meets Horace DeVere Cole through her brother, Adrian Stephen, and they have known each other at Cambridge University. They've become fast friends there. And so he comes into her life as her brother's friend, who is showing up at the house that they share, going into the drawing room, slamming the door shut. She's hearing whispering. They clearly don't want her involved. So she is curious what's happening. And at the last minute, they need two extra people, and they end up asking Virginia and another Bloomsbury Group member, Duncan Grant, to join them in this escapade.
What's the Bloomsbury Group?
The Bloomsbury Group is a small group of writers and artists who developed this kind of wonderful community in the early 20th century, where they were experimenting with writing, experimenting with art and criticism, and they were all close friends, and they celebrated friendship, life, creativity, and the arts.
Okay, so Horace picks a couple of members from the Bloomsbury Group. So let's bring in the third and final antagonist in this ridiculous story, the Dreadnought. What's going on? Well, tell us about the Dreadnought.
The Dreadnought was really the most celebrated battleship in the early 20th century. When it was launched in 1906, it was the fastest, the most powerful ship ever created. And it becomes an instant celebrity. And after new battleships were made that were even faster and more powerful, it retains this celebrity. It really captures the imagination, not only of Britons, for whom it was this symbolically powerful ship, but the entire empire and the entire world. Everybody knew about the Dreadnought. So that's when I say that when I think about the Dreadnought hoax, when the pranksters went aboard the Dreadnought in February 1910, they weren't just stepping on a deck of a ship. They were stepping on an international stage. The Dreadnought had been in the papers. Everybody knew about it. The summer before, it was a star of a naval review on the Thames. The first day of that review, a million people showed up in London. Tens of thousands
wow.
of people showed up at Southend to see it. Everybody knew what the Dreadnought was.
So we've got this very important, it's a cultural icon, almost inconceivable symbolic status to us speaking about it over a century later. I think there's another important aspect of this we need to cover before we go on to them actually doing their hoax, and that is competition between ships, pranks, whatever it might be. You tell us a little bit about competitiveness between the crews of Royal Naval ships.
Well, the week before the Dreadnought hoax, I looked at the logs of the Dreadnought, and they are constantly playing games, doing exercises. They are always interacting with other ships. Now, we don't know for sure who instigated the Dreadnought hoax, but Horace claimed he did. Adrian said a naval officer. Other people have said naval officers. But in Wolf's story, and this may or may not be true, she claimed it was the officers of the HMS Hawk, a fellow ship. Technically, that's probably can't be true because of other things that she said, but there's an ongoing competition between naval ships. And so the idea that one ship pranks another ship seems certainly possible.
It's very plausible. I mean, the idea being that the crew of one ship decided to get over on top of HMS Dreadnought's crew and to put them in their place. It rang very true to me, that. But also so dangerous and so courageous as well to actually to decide to do something. And what they did, unfortunately, is they let Horace in on the case, and suddenly it was out of their control. And here is a man who he had some crazy ideas. So what was Horace's idea? What was the hoax?
So what they would do is hire, once again, Willie Clarkson, the most famous costumer in London, have him dress them up as princes of Abyssinia. They would motor over to Lafayette Studios, get their portrait taken, because that's what foreign dignitaries did at the time. Then they would take the 3.5-hour train ride down to Weymouth. As the train is in progress, they have another co-conspirator send a telegram to Admiral May. It's his flagship. The Dreadnought is his flagship. And saying, oh, oops, this is from the Foreign Office. We forgot to tell you, but these dignitaries are going to be there in 40 minutes. May has done a million of these dog and pony shows for dignitaries. He gets everybody, you know, going. He has his officers in their full dress uniforms. So, you know, they have their swords of rank. They have their hats. They have all the gear they have to put on. They have to get the Marines lined up. The band has to have a song. They have to get the nation's flags up. So this is a huge rush. And he's doing all of this. He sends Lieutenant Willoughby down to the station. He sees what he thinks are four Abyssinians, a guy from the Foreign Office, and a German interpreter. Takes them out to the ship. They do quick introductions. The captain of the ship takes them for a tour, and 45 minutes later, they send them off, and they're back on the train to London. And it's really not till the next day that Admiral May gets a letter saying, did you have visitors yesterday? Some guy came in and said, this Cole guy, and said that he had hoaxed the Dreadnought. What's going on? And from there, things explode at the Admiralty. But I think it's important to remember that for the first 5 days, it was private. The Admiralty knew and the hoaxers knew. And according to both Virginia Woolf and her brother, they had meant to keep the whole thing private. And I think that's important because if there were naval conspirators, either an inside man or the Dreadnought or other ships, they would not have wanted this to get public. This would have just been an inside joke. But as you said, Sam, they did not count on Horace de Vere Cole, for whom publicity was the main thing in life. And so 5 days later, it gets revealed to the Daily Mail, you know, huge circulation, and bam, there it goes. A couple days after that, their photographs, the studio photographs, are printed.
Right. Let's talk about those photographs, because your book starts with the publication of this photograph. We've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 6 people here. Well, explain just who they are and what they look like, because that's the important bit.
Well, this is Virginia Woolf, who was unmarried at the time. So Virginia Stephen. It is Duncan Grant, who would go on to be a famous painter. Horace de Vere Cole, dressed as the Foreign Office liaison. Wolf's brother, Adrian Stephen. He's the tallest at 6'5". Dressed up as somebody once, I think he said, as a looking like a seedy commercial salesman in a bowler hat and some suntan cream. You also have seated Anthony Buxton, who would also go on to be a naturalist writer, and Guy Ridley. He is another one of the faux African princes. And there are four people in so-called African disguise, and then two in British dress. And it's clearly a studio photograph. And the way that they're seated looks weird to us, but it would have been immediately understandable to Edwardians who saw a million of these photographs of dignitaries from all over the world who actually had their photographs taken in this very same studio. And it looks very much like a photograph of some actual Ethiopian princes who were there for King Edward VII's coronation a few years before. So it is a striking photograph because it is set up in exactly the way one would expect for real dignitaries. But of course, they're all fake.
Yeah. Let's talk about Virginia, because she is dressed up as an Abyssinian man. She has a beard. She has a turban. She has a splendid gown of some description.
Yes, and the newspapers at the time claimed that Horace de Vere Cole spent £500, a huge amount of money at the time, just on the jewels. Now, when I look at the photograph, I'm not sure they have any jewels on. What they do have on the faux Africans are turbans, beards, elaborate costumes that perhaps were more akin to a theatrical production than an actual Ethiopian royal gown. They wear crosses around their necks because Horace understood enough about Ethiopia to know that they were Christian and they would have worn these things. And they are all looking very dignified and solemnly at the camera as though they are taking their roles in earnest.
Yeah, all of them in blackface, one of them with a blacker face than the others, which is interesting.
Yeah, you have to wonder about that. In the Zanzibar hoax, I noticed that Adrian's costume was much different than the others. And I think that's because he got there late. And so they were quickly trying to get him in costume. Right. And I do wonder if that happened again, if they were running out of time. And so they, you know, Guy Ridley, they just slap on whatever. It could have taken hours for them to get this makeup put on. And I think what's so striking, some things that are so striking to me, is in all the reporting that I read about this hoax, nobody says a word about the hoaxers in blackface makeup. And that's in part because blackface minstrel shows were so common and so popular at the time. This was one of the most common entertainments of the era. The St. James Theater in Piccadilly filled its 2,000-seat auditorium six nights a week for blackface minstrel shows. So that does not mean that people at the time did not object to this kind of theatrical performance. ABC Merriman Labor, a writer and barrister from Sierra Leone, just a few months before, had published a book, Britons Through Negro Spectacles, in which he lamented this kind of entertainment and how insulting it was to Africans who were fellow subjects of the British Empire.
Mm. I think it's particularly interesting that they got away with it, obviously, because, I mean, Virginia Woolf looks like, I know she's a woman in this, but she looks like a woman with a beard stuck on who's got blackface makeup. It doesn't look like an Abyssinian prince.
Right. I mean, you know, there's a couple things that I wonder about. I'm curious what you think about this, Sam. First of all, I was thinking they learned from the Zanzibar hoax that if you get there at dusk, you might have a better opportunity to get away with things because the light isn't very good. Second, I'm really curious about what you think about this. I have a theory that because of the military hierarchy, if your captain and your admiral are accepting these people as real Abyssinians, even if you question it, are you going to say anything?
Yeah, so it's really interesting. And that really makes a lot of sense, the way the hierarchy in the Navy would work, which means that for it to happen, you've actually, if you go in at the top and you get a level of acceptance from someone who's high enough ranking, you're going to get away with it to a certain extent. And there might have been people sniggering on board saying, actually, I don't believe this isn't right at all. So this really raises the questions of how did they get on board?
They sent a telegram, you know, just less than an hour before they were about to arrive. That got delivered right to the dreadnought, copied out, handed to Admiral May. So they somehow knew exactly how to do that. Now, Cole later on says that partly they got away with this because he went to a post office that was staffed by women and they would send anything. But that seems very unlikely. There were more women working in post offices and telegraph offices in particular. But from the research I did, it appears that anytime there was any important, particularly military kind of correspondence, that would have always been handled by men. So there was segregation in the telegraph system as well, and women were relegated to more unimportant work.
Yeah. Just the more you look into this story, the more it becomes a kind of a crazy box of frogs. So, so isn't it? It's wonderful. To me.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
When I read that bit saying he'd chosen a post office which was only staffed by women because they were less likely to question him, I simply raised a few alarm bells. They clearly had some kind of insider knowledge, knowing not only how to get in touch with someone on the dreadnought, but I think the most important thing is who to get in touch on the dreadnought. So there has to be someone who's, you could just imagine them, they're kind of, not feathers being ruffled, but just feeling honoured and important by a telegraph like this, saying there'll be some Abyssinian royalty. Because it might have helped them in their career, or they were one way or another gullible. There's a really interesting character. We don't know who's on board the dreadnought they specifically sent this to, and I think that's great.
Well, and, you know, the other thing to remember is that the Virginia and her brother Adrian have a close relative who's an officer aboard the dreadnought. Their cousin, William Fisher, is the Admiral's flag commander. The key here is they hate him. They think their Fisher cousins, as Virginia would say, would have made Eden uninhabitable. They just think he's pompous. They would love to take him down a notch. So I do think he was one of the targets, certainly for Virginia. But I also think thinking about why they had to have an inside person is important, because how did they know what day to go? The dreadnought was in harbor on the Monday they went. It wasn't on Tuesday. If they'd gone on Wednesday, it would have just been coming back from its exercises. So they needed to know when to get there, how long to stay, how to get the telegram, would they need any documents? I mean, so many things that could have gone wrong didn't. So I'm not convinced by people who argue it was just that they were incredibly lucky and it was this madcap hoax and isn't it amazing they got away with it. I think they did plan. And I think that Adrian was also an attorney. So a lot of the details meant that the actual hoaxers who went aboard the ship were not connected with any money. So there would be no transgression that they could link to an actual crime. There was only one crime that they committed, and that was that the person who sent the telegram violated a post office law. And that, but he wasn't even on the ship. They didn't have a picture of him. They do track him down. But you can imagine the poor Admiralty, what are they going to do? This guy wasn't even aboard the ship. Moreover, their lawyer is telling them, you know, you can prosecute this, but if you get a magistrate who thinks this is hilarious, he's going to fine them 40 shillings and...
Yeah, and you'll be embarrassed. Yeah. There's one other glaring question here. Why Abyssinia? Why did they decide? They've done Zanzibar, right? They've done that in Cambridge. What on earth made them think of Abyssinia? So for those of listeners who don't know, Abyssinia is what Ethiopia was known as. What's going on there?
Well, I think there's a couple of reasons. Perhaps the primary one is that Emperor Menelik, and they're pretending to be relatives of Menelik, was incredibly famous at the time. He's a household word. He has employed European PR agents to project his image to the world. Ethiopia is being sold as the African Alps. Everybody knows who he is. He's reported in the newspaper. So he's a quite familiar figure. So saying that you're related to Menelik, a lot of people would know that. I also think that for the hoaxers who all went to public school, and for Americans listening, that's private school, they had a classical education full of Greek and Latin writers. And so many Greek writers, Homer and Herodotus and the Greek myths, talk about Ethiopia and Ethiopian people. So I think that many of the hoaxers really saw what was called Abyssinia at the time as this incredibly romantic place that was deeply, whose history or stories were deeply woven into the classical education that they had gotten as schoolboys.
So they managed to get on board. We've got three men and we've got one woman all dressed up as bearded Abyssinian princes. What happens next? What do they do? How do they speak?
Well, so Adrian, who wrote a memoir of this in the 1930s, claimed that on their way down that 3.5-hour trip from London to Weymouth, that they pick up a book of Swahili words in the train station and try to memorize a few on their way down. So many problems with that story.
It's brilliant.
First of all, if Horace de Vere Cole knew that they were Christians, he made up names for them that began with the with RAS, Ross, which is an Ethiopian word for royalty. So he knew it was Amharic and not Swahili. So they knew, in my opinion, quite well that they did not speak Swahili. This is all part of the ongoing joke, I believe.
I should just say that Swahili is the language they speak on the east coast of Africa. It goes right down the coast there, so not in Ethiopia.
Right, exactly. So they claim they get there, and Adrian starts in on his Swahili, but he only has 5 or 6 words, quickly runs out of it, and so he decides off the cuff that he will just use his schoolboy education, and he starts reciting lines from the Aeneid, and he just garbles them because he figures that the naval officers won't have that classical education and won't recognize it, and that works perfectly, and they don't recognize it at all. But I don't think any of that's true. I mean, if my theory of an inside man on the ship is true, they might have had to say a few words at the introductions at the very beginning, but then they're just with their escort for the rest of the time and they don't have to speak anything. And part of the reason I believe that is because Adrian, what he wanted to be more than anything was an actor, and he was in several performances and he was actually quite good, as it turns out. So as an actor, I think he would have been committed to learning his role and would have had a vocabulary. On the other hand, you know, he's with madcap Horace de Vere Cole, so who knows? Maybe they were just being ridiculous.
Well, I mean, they were all being ridiculous, but I'm quite a silly person. I appreciate the ridiculousness of this. There is no way I could have done it without laughing.
Right. Oh, exactly. Exactly. And especially when they're facing their first cousin who greets them they're in disguise.
Another point we should mention. They're not anonymous.
They're not anonymous.
Their first cousin is on board.
First cousins. Moreover, the captain of the ship, Captain Richmond, is in a very small walking club with Virginia's brother, Adrian. So they have spent miles walking across the countryside together. And again, as I said before, Adrian is 6'5". His disguise is a bowler hat and some suntan powder on his face. There's no way the captain wouldn't have recognized him.
Wow, there's so much more here. When it all unravels and they're discovered, what happened? Were they punished? Were they held accountable at all?
Oh boy, some people really wanted them to be held accountable. As incredible as it seems, they were discussed in the House of Commons. And there were members of Parliament who wanted to see them taken into account. But, you know, the Admiralty, more than anyone, really wanted them to be arrested and punished. But it turned out that only Guy Ridley had violated the Post Office Act, and they were quite afraid that the magistrate would not give them a severe punishment. A magistrate they could have gotten up to a year imprisonment with or without hard labor, but that was a big risk. And after a couple of months, this went on. I mean, it was reported globally for at least 2 months after the hoax. And by that time, Admiral May had cooled off and he didn't want to risk more embarrassment. He didn't want to bring it up again. He sort of really realized you have to just let this go and it will go away. If you keep the drama going, the newspapers are loving this story. And they will, if you get a trial, this just is more, these are more headlines. So they, in the end, they completely got away with it. They were not punished at all.
Well, one of the things that I think is fascinating about it is this, the very, very intelligent Virginia being part of it as well, was it just like a student prank and they really didn't think it through? Or had they actually thought it through? Were they deliberately mocking something? What was the purpose behind it? I think this is really interesting, considering we know that Virginia's views on race and empire, especially.
I would say that each of the pranksters had different motives. I think that Horace DeVere Cole's motive was to be famous, and he would do whatever that took. And he was probably incredibly motivated to hoax a world famous ship. I think Virginia was motivated by, and her brother, probably Virginia and Adrian were motivated by the idea of hoaxing their cousin and embarrassing him. The other hoaxers, I don't know. But it's important to do a caveat for Virginia, because over time, she reinterprets the hoax as she retells the story as a really anti-colonial, anti-imperialist, feminist statement. And she will tell stories she'll write short stories in the 1920s where she brings in the hoax and really shows it as a way to make fun of masculine patriarchal ideas of honor and power. So over time, she definitely sees it as anti-imperialist. But I'm not convinced that's how she thought of it in 1910. But I think that's one of the interesting things about stories that become legends, which the Dreadnought hoax did. Its meanings change over time. And that's one of the things that has really interested me about this hoax, because loads of hoaxes took place in 1910. And this is the only one we remember, because as it's retold over the years, it allows us to explore different problems and anxieties that we're suffering in our own time. And I think, for example, in 1910, the newspapers were obsessed about the idea of a woman masquerading as a man. For us today in the 21st century, after our racial reckoning, for us, it's the idea of this incredible pacifist, feminist, well-educated woman dressing in blackface. How could we can't reconcile that? It's difficult for us to put those things together.
Yeah. I think what's clear is that they, for whatever the motivations were at the time, they're very happy poking the society that they're part of, and then particularly poking the Royal Naval aspect of it, because considering you can't consider the Navy as an institution which is the same as the society of which it was part. It's fundamentally different, culturally distinct, but both they found a way of poking them both at the same time, which I think is fascinating.
Yeah, and I think one thing that they did that might be hard for us to see today is that they chose black princes, and that really put into conflict two hierarchies of understanding the world. You have this old order where the god is first, and then the king or the queen, and then the aristocracy. So you have this old world order where being royalty is gives you the utmost status. You also have this new hierarchy, which is based on Darwinian ideas. And this is where pseudoscientists have come up with this idea of the races of mankind that have white people at the top of a hierarchy and black-skinned people at the bottom. So what they basically did is they posed as people who, because they were aristocrats, commanded deference by ordinary people, even military officers. But at the same time, they were black. And so according to this new pseudoscience, they were inferior to everyone. So they really brought those two conflicting ideas about hierarchies and the human condition into conflict with each other. And I think that was one of the things that is easy for us to lose sight of, and that made the hoax so interesting, I think, at the time, and perhaps motivated Horace DeVere Cole really juxtaposing those two things.
Mm. Yeah. Well, it's an extraordinary story. I'd encourage everyone listening to this podcast to get the book and read it. Just tell us about the book in which you you describe this story so well.
Right. So this is called The Girl Prince, Virginia Woolf, Race, and the Dreadnought Hoax. And you can pretty much get it anywhere, online or in bookstores, published by Hearst. And it is... is this fair to say, Sam? It's really not a dry book. I try to tell good stories in it.
It's amazing. It's also impossible not to tell this story in an entertaining way. So, and you've done that absolutely brilliantly. I mean, the sources available are also fascinating. There's so much there for historians. But Dana, thank you very much indeed for sharing this with us today.
Oh, Sam, thank you so much for having me. It was really fun. And I know we could probably talk the rest of the day.
Thank you all so much for listening. Now, if you want to find out more, please go and buy Danielle's book. It's called The Girl Prince, Virginia Woolf, Race and the Dreadnought Hoax. Please don't forget that this podcast comes from both the Society for Nautical Research and the Lloyd's Register Foundation. You can find the SNR at snr.org.uk, where you can join up. It's a brilliant way of supporting the podcast. Please, please join up. I can't urge you anymore. It's a brilliant way not only of finding out about the past from the very best in the business, but also of meeting like-minded people. And the Lloyd's Register Foundation's Heritage and Education Centre you can find at hec.lrfoundation.org.uk, and you can look into all of their extraordinary projects that they're up to at the minute. And please, in particular, look out, search it out, find it and watch it. Maritime Innovation in Miniature, filming the world's best ship models with the very latest camera equipment. The results are completely astonishing.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.